and welcome to Two Chairs Talking, the podcast where we talk about the books we've been reading, the movies we've been seeing, and about anything else we feel like. Why is this podcast called Two Chairs Talking? Simple. My name is David Grigg, and I was the chairman of the 43rd World Science Fiction Commission held in Melbourne, Australia in 1985. My co-host is Perry Middlemiss, the chairman of the 57th World Science Fiction Commission held in Melbourne in 1999, and the co-chair of the, what was it, the 68th? Yes, the 68th.
So many numbers.
The 68th Worldcon held in Melbourne in 2010. So say hello, Perry.
Hello, David. Hello, listener.
Listener, I hope you have more than one. Perry and I are rather obviously both science fiction fans, or we wouldn't have found ourselves in the unenviable position of running major science fiction conventions. But both of us also read a lot of other genres, particularly crime. Beyond that, I don't know, what do you read, Perry, beyond crime and science fiction?
Just about anything I can get my hands on, really. Basically anything that sort of takes my fancy. So I can jump from biographies of Matthew Flinders or Bruce Springsteen's autobiography, already in my top five for the year, straight away.
Bruce Springsteen.
Always been a big Bruce Springsteen fan. But a lot of science fiction, and a lot of crime. But also, I've had a big interest in Australian literature. So for about 7 or 8 years, I ran a literature, Australian literature blog, or a lit blog, as they used to be called in those days, called Matilda. And that basically ran a lot of reviews of Australian literature, which was everything from literary stuff, horror, SF, crime, anything that I could basically come across and anything that I could find. And also ran a number of reprints of Australian poetry as well. So I've got a big interest in Australian poetry, but not modern poetry. Yeah. Sorry, there's for all of us, I guess, at some stage or other, there's got to be a line that's got to be drawn in terms of around the areas of your interest, purely and simply to keep it under control, but also because that's just the areas you're interested in. So my Australian poetry stuff runs out about Second World War. Mm. But Australian literature, novels and so on, goes beyond that up until now.
I was a big fan of, I guess I still am a big fan of Christopher Brennan.
Oh, yeah.
Australian poet.
Yep.
And actually used one of his poems at our wedding as part of the ceremony when Sue and I were married 40 years ago.
Well, he was a very strange Sydney-based poet that just was not like anybody else that was around at that time. And he just seemed to be just completely different. You know, he was very different from the old bush poets that were around back in the 1880s.
Henry Lawson's and so on.
But he came, he was a bit strange. And I think that he did actually sort of kick off, though I'm not a literature major in any way, shape or form, I think he did kick off a bit of a change in terms of how Australian poetry was run at the time. Because he was much more sort of European looking rather than looking at Australia, which was interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. I always remember his poem, Under a Sky of Uncreated Mud, or Sunk Beneath the Accursed Streets. It goes on. I can't remember how it goes on. But yeah, there's, it always appealed to me.
Well, I can always find when I'm reading, having a look at bits of Brennan's poetry, that it strikes me that his poetic phrases are perfect science fiction novel titles.
Absolutely.
There's so many of them. They're looking up, I'd like to read a book called that.
Yeah, there was another one I actually took a book title from, which was When Starkeld and the Dread of Space in Icy Silence Bind the Main.
Space opera. Absolutely. There you are. Right there. It's space opera all the way right down the line.
Okay, well, I didn't expect that we'd start off by talking about Australian poetry, but there you are. This is the whole point of this podcast. We can talk about anything we want to, and we will. What I was going to ask next, Perry, was that you seem to read an incredible number of books every year. So how many was it last year?
126, I think.
126. How do you read that many books?
Don't watch TV. Well, I do, but I don't watch a lot of television. Mm. 5 or 6 years ago, maybe even 8 years ago, I probably watched a lot more of television, a lot more of the drama stuff that was around at that stage. If you remember, probably close to 10 years ago now since Breaking Bad started. Mm-hmm. But I'd already been watching The Sopranos and prior to that West Wing and prior to that X-Files. Mm-hmm. So you get a nice progression of stuff going all the way right through. But when I got to the end of Breaking Bad, although there's still a couple of episodes at the end I still haven't got around to watching, which my son keeps on giving me a hard time about all the time, I came to the realisation that there's only a certain amount of time, spare time, that you've got in a particular day, so that you have time in the evening, maybe on the train, maybe at lunchtime. If you use up a lot of that time watching television, then it doesn't leave you much time for anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And basically about 4 or 5 years ago, which I'll go into a lot more detail later on.
Yeah, we have many episodes to go.
We do. I came to the realization that I had a huge number of books in my house that I hadn't actually read.
Yes.
In fact, I was staring at the all the paperbacks up on the shelf, and for whatever reason, Silverberg must have been just about eye level when I was looking at it, and I saw Dying Inside by Silverberg. Nominated for a Hugo in the year that it was eligible, but didn't win. Can't quite remember what it lost to, but whatever it was, I think was, it might have been The Gods Themselves by Isaac Asimov, which I considered to be a fairly awful book.
Yeah.
But we can, there's one or two parts of it which are all right, but in general, it's crap. But Dying Inside, fantastic novel about a telepath who's slowly but surely losing his powers, and what that does to him, and how that impacts him and impacts his relationship with everybody else, and how he has to come to live in the world that all the rest of us live in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fantastic novel. Yeah. And I read it and I looked at it and I thought, and I looked at the how much I paid for it. It was probably about 35 cents or something.
Yes.
I looked at the edition and realized it had been sitting on my shelf for probably 35 years, untouched, unloved, until I came to read it. And then I suddenly realized I don't actually have time left in the rest of my life to actually read this again.
Mm-hmm.
And I then looked at all the rest of the novels that were sitting up there on the bookshelf and realized I wasn't going to have time to read them again unless I read them the once.
Yep.
So I had the thought that I've got to get started. Mm. I've got to get into this. And so I just basically started setting up a reading list and an idea to basically just get into it and start reading the stuff that I wanted to read that had been around for a long time that I'd never gotten to, but also trying to keep up with all the new stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, of course, is just impossible. You can't. You just can't keep up.
Well, it's impossible, absolutely impossible. I remember as a child realizing with horror at some point in my early teens probably that I was never going to read every book in the world. And it's the terrible, terrible realization that it was just impossible. But it's not in that you can't even read every new book that comes out.
No, you can't.
There must be millions published every year.
I remember when I was doing that lip blog, Matilda, at one stage, somebody in an American blog said something along the lines of, oh, look, there was 125, 140 or so Australian literary fiction novels published in 1 year. That's enough for you to keep up with.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but you can't do anything else.
No, that's right.
And that's the whole point. You can basically dedicate yourself to looking at all of that.
One niche,
One niche or nothing. Yeah. Now, if you like, as you said, and as I've seen the way that you do your reading, you're reading a lot of crime fiction, especially a lot of Australian crime fiction at the moment, and I'm doing some of that and also reading all the other bits that I want to get to.
Yeah.
You can't concentrate just on one thing.
Yeah. Now, you told me earlier that that you set targets. Why do you set targets? Targets for how much of a particular genre you're going to read? How much by a particular gender you're going to read?
The reason why I picked the gender, why I wanted to make sure that I'm trying to get a good balance of male and female authors, is that I had a look at the books that I read 6 or 7 years ago. And it wasn't all that many at that point. This is before I really sort of started to go into second and third gear and get stuck into it and read on the train, at lunchtime, at night, just about every day. I realised that when I went back and had a look at stuff from about 2012, 2013, that I had read maybe 40 books in the year and only one of them was by a female author.
Mm.
And you look at that and you think, nah, if I'm going to basically get to the point where I say I'm not going to read all science fiction or all crime or all literature, I then also can't do the same thing by saying I'm going to read all men or all women.
No.
You've got to have a combination of the two. And as splitting it 50-50 seemed like a pretty good way of looking at it. But then you also, when you start going that line, this gets into a rabbit hole like you would not believe. Okay. You then start thinking, well, I've really got to start reading more translated books as well. Because, you can't just read straight English orientated or original books. You've then got to start spreading your wings.
Mm.
And if you do that, You're lost. Yeah. You're completely and utterly lost.
It could be a labyrinth of quotas. Yeah.
Well, it is. And the thing then is that you have to sort of set yourself, well, I'm going to read a certain number of SF, certain number of fantasy, certain number of crime, thrillers, spy novels, non-fiction, biography. Mm. You set yourself a certain target for how many you're going to read in a year, and it gives you a program, a reading program there, then and there. Now, this doesn't work for everybody.
No.
A lot of people will say, I don't have time to read. I'm still working, so I get to talk to a few people, and people see you reading and, at lunchtime. And the weird thing is they want to come and sit and talk to you.
Yes. You feel like saying, I'm going to interrupt you.
I can talk to you all day, mm-hmm. and you're going to sit there and talk to me over my lunch when I'm having my sandwich or whatever it is I'm having, and I'm reading something because I need to basically finish this to keep up with the program, and you're going to interrupt me and then tell me that you don't read books.
Yes.
And I think, yes, now I understand why.
Yeah. I don't think I can cope with a quota system, as it were, but what I do try to sort of navigate a little bit of a path, I suppose. And this year I've been trying to read more Australian books by Australian authors. I think I've succeeded in that so far this year. But
do you keep track of what you do?
Oh, absolutely.
And then keep referring back.
Yeah,
to
it? Absolutely. I mean, I'm on Goodreads like you are, I think, and I sort of do that reading challenge every year, and that's quite useful to be able to sort of scan back and see what I've been reading, and and I put things on different shelves. So, for example, every Australian author I read, I put that book onto my Australian authors shelf in Goodreads. That means I can quickly look back and see what I've been doing in that regard.
Do you find that you change your reading list coming up, your to-be-read list, or your immediate to-be-read list? Do you change that based on where you feel as though you're sitting with those shelves?
Yeah, to a certain degree, yeah.
So you're doing targets?
Well, it's a notional thing. You're actually setting numeric targets. I just have this vague concept of what I might be reading next.
Okay. Two different ways of approaching the same problem.
Ways of doing it, that's exactly right. Now, look, we haven't sort of figured out a real structure for how we're going to do these podcasts, but we sort of had the idea that we'd each perhaps talk about one of the best books we read this year or the last month or whenever since we last had a podcast. And then we possibly might talk about a book we've both read and disagree about. We might do that. We might do that this podcast, this episode. We might not. We might do that some other time. Do you have a particular book in mind that you'd like to talk about, Perry?
Well, unfortunately, the book that I wanted to talk about is one that is on the current Hugo ballot, which is one that I didn't like.
Oh, you didn't like it? No.
So there.
You can talk about books you don't
like. Yeah, well, I'm going to talk about one I didn't like. This is one of them, unfortunately.
Well, do you want to go first or will I go first?
Well, I can go first. The book that I wanted to talk about was A Record of a Spaceborne Few by Becky Chambers. Becky Chambers came into the consciousness of science fiction, at least in my consciousness, a couple of years ago with her first self-published novel, A Long Way to a Small Angry Planet. Now, that's a great title, a fantastic title. The book was space opera-ish because it's basically space opera. It's basically somebody joining the spaceship crew, and they are traveling to a long way to this small planet, which is rather angry. Mm. As the planet's angry because it's angry about everybody else coming in and trying to contact them because they want to be left alone.
Yeah.
Most of us can understand that perspective. And while the book was okay, it got nominated for a few awards, which I really couldn't quite understand because I didn't think it was outstanding by any stretch of the imagination, but it was. It reminded me a lot of an episode of the standard TV space operas you get, you know, Star Trek Voyager or just any of the Star Trek stuff, or Firefly. Now, that's not to denigrate those by any stretch of the imagination, because I'm just saying that it's like that sort of style.
Yep.
And so I read it and I thought, well, I've seen all this stuff before. And it was okay, but it wasn't terribly spectacular. Anyway, so it did all right, and good luck to her. She started off as a self-published author and did well, sold a number of copies, then got to, she got a contract for another couple of books. So there's now been two others published in the series, not utilising the same set of characters, although there have been a couple of characters that are sort of slightly connected between the novels. I haven't liked them enough to go back and try and figure that out. So if there are, and I haven't given her credit for it, my apologies. The second book was better in terms of how it was written. Not a lot happens, but it was at least a little bit more interesting. The title of which escapes me just at the moment. The third one, Record of a Spaceborne Few, you can see what she attempted to set out to do. She tried to write a science fiction novel about humans who have left a devastated Earth, have spent a long period of time, although it's never terribly sure, I'm never terribly sure how long that period is, to where they have reached a destination, but I really wasn't terribly sure where that destination was, nor how it seemed to gel with the rest of the things in the novel. And she's written it as a sort of a space opera. The only problem with the book that I found was that it's got very little space and no opera. So there's no drama to it at all. It's a set of character vignettes where basically it's this person does this on the ship that's basically floating there because they're off planet. They've always been off planet. And now they've reached a certain point where they can, where some of the inhabitants of the ship can go down and live on a planet. Do they go? Do they stay? If everybody goes, then what happens to the ship and all the culture and the history that's all left there? So the whole thing's sort of reasonable.
Interesting premise.
Yeah, interesting premise. And so because this is a fleet, one of the ships in the fleet actually gets blown up halfway through. And I thought, oh, something's going to happen. And it does for about 10 or 15 pages. And then the main character that's going to have a look at this thing dies. And that's it. And that's why I said it's sort of an opera, but there's no drama to it at all. You know, the fat lady never sings. You get to the end and you think, the only thing I could think of when I got to the end of it was, well, I'm glad I got through that.
That's a bad feeling.
Unfortunately, you know, I quite like the other two books, this one. I don't get. And it's quite obvious to me when looking at the good, we were mentioning Goodreads earlier, which I find a very, very useful website.
Sure.
You go and have a look at the reviews that people have written up about this particular book, and they seem to be very conflicted about it. A lot of people are saying, this is an absolutely fantastic book. I'm going to sit and wallow in it, and I loved it. I gave it 5 stars.
Yeah.
And other people like me are sitting there going, nah, I'll give it 2. I mean, I haven't come across any, though there probably are some where people have said, you know, if I could give this 0.5 star, I would, because it sounds like the reviews are giving it that. I just don't think, for me, it does anything. I didn't get anything out of it, and it's a book that I am going to be completely forget.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's on the ballot, and that's why
on the
I read it.
For the Hugo as well.
Which is why I read it this year. Yeah. So,
who knows?
Unfortunate. Yeah. There we go.
There's some awful books get awarded for it, sort of not awarded necessarily, but put on nominations for awards.
And yet, every now and again, you'll come across something that is absolutely a stunner that's landed on one particular awards list and is never mentioned again.
Yeah.
And you sort of think,
why? Yeah.
There was a book a couple of years ago I read, Memory of Water, by a Finnish writer. I think it was on one list, and that was the only reason why I found it. And I thought it was just a cracker. It was really, really good.
And do you think that's because it was in translation or?
Partly that. I think partly, well, there's a big problem. There's a big problem with fiction in translation all the way right across the world. It is not set purely and simply as a problem inside the SF genre. It was there for a long period of time in crime, but that seems to be moving a little bit now with all the Scandi Noir that came out over the last 20 odd years, I guess. Henning Menkel and all the rest of them.
Miss Miller's Feeling for Snow.
That's good. That's 1980s, isn't it?
Yeah, it would be 1980s.
But 1980s, yeah, that's right. So that may be one of the first ones. And there's a number of those other ones, you know. Most of the names that I try to pronounce, I'm going to sort of absolutely wreck. But Indrason from Iceland, a lot of good stuff that's come out. So they seem to have got over that problem, and that seems to, the translated novels out of the crime genre seem to have moved into the mainstream of that genre.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's necessarily happened so much with science fiction. Stanislaus Lem was probably a big one early. But, you know, There hasn't been, still not a lot now.
No.
Though...
Well, Lame, of course, was famously thrown out of the SF Writers of America for saying rude things about American science fiction, if I recall.
Which probably at that time was not...
A while ago.
Was not such a... Not so hard to say because, you know, you go back and look at... we were talking about the gods themselves earlier on by Asimov. Yeah. And you go back and look at that and you read some of Asimov's stuff now.
Yeah, it's hard.
And you think it's very thin.
Mm.
It's very thin.
Mm. All right. Well, thank you for that. Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about a book which isn't science fiction, although it has fantastic elements to it, or certainly whimsical elements to it, which is Boy Swallows Universe by Trent Dalton. It's an Australian author. It's a semi-autobiographical novel. And it's the story of Eli Bell, a boy who is growing up in an environment which is foreign to most of us. Grows up in Darra, which is a miserable, forlorn suburb of Brisbane. His mother and stepfather are heroin dealers. His babysitter is an ex-convict named Slim Halliday, who is sometimes known as the Houdini of Boggo Road because he managed to escape. So this could have been another depressing story of growing up in miserable circumstances. The Irish are very good at books like those. But what transforms the book for me is how fondly nostalgic it remains. It's a very nostalgic look back at his childhood. But it's very definitely fictionalized in all sorts of ways. But I'd like to read his description of the suburb of Darra. Now, I have no idea whether this is actually a real suburb, but anyway, this is his description of Darra in the book. Darra is a dream, a stench, a spilt garbage bin, a cracked mirror, a paradise, a bowl of Vietnamese noodle soup filled with prawns, domes of plastic crab meat, pig ears and pig knuckles and pig belly. Darra is a girl washed down a drainpipe, a boy with snot slipping from his nose so ripe it glows on Easter night, a teenage girl stretched across a train track waiting for the express to Central and beyond, a South African man smoking Sudanese weed, a Filipino man injecting Afghani dope next door to a girl from Cambodia sipping milk from Queensland's Darling Downs. Darra is my quiet sigh, my reflection on war, my dumb preteen longing, my home. But as I said before, there is kind of a running element of fantasy in the novel. But if it's not fantasy, then I'll call it whimsy. The book starts when Eli is 12. Eli's brother August, who is 1 year older than him at 13, hasn't spoken a word since he was 6. And no one quite knows why. Despite that, August is intelligent. He can write, does well at school, and he communicates via signs or by writing. And another quote here. It was August who taught me about details, how to read a face, how to extract as much information as possible from the non-verbal, how to mine expression and conversation and story from the data of every last speechless thing that is right before your eyes, the things that are talking to you without talking to you. It was August who taught me that I didn't always have to listen, I might just have to look. That actually becomes a key part of the book where Eli is almost employed at a point for his ability to observe every little thing. August sometimes writes with his finger in the air, just scribbling in the air with his pointed finger. Eli, who is long accustomed to this, can read what August writes as easily as if it were words written on paper. But what August writes can be eerily cryptic. Your end is a dead blue wren. Boy swallows universe. All of these cryptic phrases eventually make sense in the context of the novel, and we discover why August has been silent for so long. It's the mutual love of these two boys which gets them through some terrible times and helps them survive the climax of the book, where a drug czar with political connections sets out to kill them. I loved this book. I thought it was authentically Australian. It was fascinating in its grim, realistic details and in its touches of fantasy. And it's a book I'd like to reread. I'd be happy to read or reread several times. That's my recommendation for the month.
Well, I had this book recommended to me over a drunken lunch at the MCG about 6 months ago. I've actually got a copy of it. I've bought it. It's there. Mm. I didn't know you were going to talk about it, but I've already bought a copy and I'd like to get to it. Mm. From what you've said, it seems like it's, I gather, a bit on the harrowing side. But
there are certainly harrowing details in it. The drug czar is not a gentle person. And the drug trade is not a gentle trade. And so, eventually some fairly gruesome things happen. But there's some really interesting and fun things in there where, For example, at one point his mother has been thrown into jail for being a heroin dealer, and he essentially breaks into Boggo Road prison to see his mother. He breaks into the prison in order to see his mother.
It's probably easier to break into a prison than it is to break out of one. But even so,
absolutely. So that's fun. Yeah, it's a really good book. So that's probably my fiction read of the year, really, so far.
There's a fair bit of buzz about this book at the moment.
Yeah, it's done very well. I don't know whether it's certainly, you know, it's won awards yet, but it's certainly been nominated for things, I think.
I would think that most of the Australian Fiction Awards probably haven't rolled through just as yet.
No.
Certainly things like the Miles Franklin hasn't come up.
No.
Not that we're saying that it's probably going to be nominated for that, but weirder books have ended up on the Miles Franklin Award list.
Indeed.
You know, it's quite possible that it might pick up for those. And there's quite a large number of other Australian literary awards around as well. Just about every state's got one. Premier's got one. A few of the newspapers used to have them, but The Age shut down a few years back. So there's... I'm certain there's one Australian Book Industry Awards that get nominated for that, quite possibly. But there's just so many to keep track of, it's almost impossible again.
Indeed.
We're back to that problem of...
How can we possibly cope with even reading a tiny fraction of what's published? That's true.
Yeah, so you've got to get to the point, I think, where you decide that you flow. You go with your flow. You basically figure out what sort of stuff you like, and then you move around and you take recommendations from other people, and hopefully a few people will get some recommendations from what we talk about here.
Yeah,
maybe not Record of a Spaceball and Few,
perhaps not
that one, even though it is on the Hugo list. And you may, if you read it, get a better reaction to it than I did, but that is what happens. So.
Well, then tell me, you talked about a book you didn't like. What's the best book you've read this year?
I've got two at the moment that are sitting in my top five. Basically, as I go through the year, I keep track of what I'm going to put into my top five for the year in all the different categories, you know, science fiction, fantasy, horror, crime, and so on. But I also now have decided that what I do is I'm going to put my best five as well. And the two that I've got on those, two that I've got in that category at the moment is the Springsteen autobiography, because as I told you, I'm a big Springsteen fan. And the other one is Possession by A.S. Byer.
Oh, yes, that's a great book.
Now, we've spoken about this one because I remember talking to you about this one a few weeks back, and I told you that I was reading it, and I thought it was just a stunner. I'd forgotten how good it was.
Yeah.
I read it, I was living in England at the time when it came out in the early 90s, 1991, something like that. I won the Booker in 91 or 92.
Yep.
And I remember reading it at the time and just being blown away by the whole literary concept of it all, because it touches in with a lot of that sort of epic poetry style from the Victorian era, but also touches on the fringes of the Pre-Raphaelites as well, and takes in that whole piece where things were massively changing throughout the whole of Britain and throughout the whole of Europe, I would guess, but we're talking about Britain here in particular, although bits of France as well is in this. And it reminded me a bit of possibly my favourite ever book, John Fowles' novel, The French Lieutenant's Woman.
Yes, it's a good book.
Which I've probably read four or five times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the ones where I'm loath to say that I'm only going to read it once.
Yes.
I reckon I'm probably about due to go back and read it again.
Yeah.
And then I will probably keep on reading it about every 8 to 10 years or so. Mm. Because every time I read it, I pick up something new.
Yeah.
And I certainly seem to pick up something new from Possession this year that I hadn't remembered reading or picking up on back in 1990. And that sort of comes to the situation where if you reread books over your life, the things that you appreciated and liked at an earlier age are not necessarily going to be those things that you're going to like at a later time.
That's right.
And that is just changing taste. Mm. And that's just changing knowledge of literary styles, customs, what's possible to do in a novel and what isn't, and how the person's gone about doing it.
Mm.
I was just blown away from the fact that there's just massive amounts of big epic poetry in there.
Yes, which she's written.
Which she's written.
In two completely different styles.
Exactly, which is really quite excellent.
That's good poetry.
As I said earlier, I'm not a literary scholar, but I you can sit and read it and go, actually, I like this. This is really good stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Because she writes the poetry of the male character and the poetry of the female character, and two different, very different, different people. And she manages somehow to make the style work differently for very differently for each one.
Well, it was interesting also that she runs the book and runs the whole of the plot like a thriller.
Mm.
So it's basically trying to find a connection. Somebody thinks they found a connection between a particular major poet and this minor female novelist and poet. And this person just finds some documents which have never been seen before, which lead to two people getting together and basically following along a line, trying to work out what sort of connection there is, having to put up with everybody else that's trying to steal their thunder and take over the control because there's all these scholars who are saying, well, this is my author, this is my life's work here. How dare you come in and steal all this stuff? But it's run really well. And it's like a 500, almost 600 page novel, big and solid book. And it just reads like a normal...
A thriller.
Just like a thriller mystery. Yeah, and it's beautifully done.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think she's written anything as good since, but that's good. That's terrific. That's
hard to top. And I think that a lot of... Some of the big organisations, like... You would have heard of the 1001 books you would need to read before you die. It's like that series. 1001 films you need to see. 1001 books you need to read before you die. It's in that. And The Guardian also did a... list of a while back of the 1,000 best novels ever published in English, and that's in there as well.
Yes, right.
So it's got to the point where it has got a lot of cachet all the way right down the line, but it's an excellent book. And if you give that to people and say, see, this is what the booker could be, this is what it could be giving people to.
Well, I've read some great novels which won the booker. That was certainly one of them. The other one was The Luminaries.
Oh, yeah, I haven't got to that one. But there's also been
a few. The author's name. Yeah.
There's also been some, and you sort of think, what the hell? Yeah, like, Vernon Godlittle by D.B.C. Pierre. Yeah. Didn't get that one at all. I really did not. But there's also, they lead you, some of the prizes and the shortlist lead you on to sets of authors that you would never necessarily find any other way.
In your comfort zone, that's for sure. Yeah. Look, I think we've probably been talking for long enough, don't you?
We're supposed to
talk about a book we disagreed about, but we ended up talking about a book we both thoroughly agree on. So that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. So that might be a good night from me and good night from Perry.
Good night.
Good night. Good afternoon.
Wherever you are.
Wherever you are. Good morning. Okay.
Anywhere, anywhen.
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 Good point. Okay. Ciao.